Hey, y'all, if you enjoy watching your podcast, which seems kind of weird, watching your podcast, but some people really enjoy that. So we have a YouTube channel. You can find it at Heather Parady, P-A-R-A-D-Y. It's also linked up in the show notes. You can hit subscribe. And several of these interviews are actually in person, so you can watch that. Again, that is at Heather Parady on YouTube. Eric Anderson is a two-time Emmy Award-winning director. He is known in part for crafting some of television's most iconic title sequences. He also directs several commercials that I promise you you've seen. And side note, was elected to the executive committee of the Emmy Awards at the Academy of Television and Art Scientists. So here's the situation. This dude eats, breathes, has lived his entire life making things. Y'all haven't even heard half the story. Starting off as a successful musician and owner of a recording studio, he decided to leave it all behind and go into the world of film. What he's learned over the past few decades is wild. I ran across him on Instagram, loved his visual work. So good. And y'all know me, I'm weird. I'm like, Eric, I want to know who you are. In this conversation, you're going to hear, as a creative, it's imperative that we get bored sometimes. Is there a spiritual element to creativity? And how to differentiate between a dry spell in your work and the realization that maybe I shouldn't be doing this? This, my friend, is the wildly talented Eric Anderson.
So I think boredom is something that everybody should aspire to because it's kind of what keeps you creative. The times I've been cautious in my life have been the least productive and the most boring times of my life. The times where I've been a little crazy and getting in well over my head have always completely turned out just fine.
Is it true that the studio was haunted? That's what you said on Somewhere Else.
Oh yeah, it's haunted.
I mean, no, it was.
People saw things there.
Eric Anderson, I've been super excited to talk to you. I've actually been thinking about asking you on the show for a couple of months, but just hadn't pulled the plug just yet. But when I ran across your work, I was just taken away by the talent that you had just from your Instagram feed. I knew that you were up to something amazing. I had no idea what you had done with your career, the huge track record, multifaceted, creative, and the rooms that you've been in, the things that you've been able to make is insane. And when I started digging into your work, holy shit, dude, like it is incredible what you've put out and made for yourself. You started off, correct me if I'm off on this, wanting to be a musician. The love you had originally was music, I believe. So start me off there because I want to go through a little bit of your life story and then I have some creative process questions.
Sure.
But super pumped you came on the show. Thanks for joining us. Tell me about this music situation.
Well, I was a successful musician. I think I could have been a studio musician for my livelihood. That's what I started
really
doing. Yeah, I was. And it really, it's just a lifelong story and it goes so deep. So I made friends with this kid in middle school and he said, hey, you should play the bass because there's all these guitarists and we don't have a bass player and you should play the bass because you're, you know, good guy. And I said, oh, okay. So I went home and I said, hey, I'm going to play the bass. And so we went and, you know, rented a bass guitar from Jerry's Music. And my mom was like, if you're going to play the bass, you're going to learn how to do it right. So, you know, you're going to take lessons. So the guitar hero in town was, you know, the guitar teacher. So I went to my first lesson and he said, hey, learn this one song by Cheap Trick. And I was like, okay, great. You know, for next week. Right. So I went home and I learned the one song in about two lessons and I learned the entire record. And I was able to play the entire record. It was like, it came so natural to me. Playing bass was really easy. I failed at, you know, playing acoustic guitar, but playing bass was really easy. So I went back for my next lesson. And then he said, did you learn that one song? And I said, I learned the record. And he's like, oh, bullshit. It's like, no way you learned the record. And I was like, I learned the entire record. And so I played it for him. And he said, you're going to be a great bassist. And I think that to me, going through my career, there's been a handful of times where that sort of encouragement came right at the perfect time. And so he said, I'm going to be a great bassist. And he was a hero of mine. So now I had something to kind of live up to. So I had to be a great bassist. So I had to work at it. So that's how I started my freshman year of high school. And then I went on to start recording with, I made my own, you know, multi-track system with two cassette decks and bouncing back and forth and playing an instrument when I was bouncing and going back. And that led to, you know, me becoming, you know, good friends with my friend Mark Walk. And he and I started recording together, but he got a job at this music store. And the music store allowed him to take home equipment on Friday night or on Saturday night, as long as it was back in the office or back in the store by the time it opened. And so we would just record all weekend, multi-track recording. And this is the, you know, this is the early 80s, you know, probably 84. Not a lot of this stuff was brand new, but we would take a multi-track system home. We would take Roland keyboards. We'd take the, you know, 808 drum machines and all this sort of stuff. Wire this whole house that he was renting up at the time for $65 a month. We would, you know, run microphones everywhere, put things in the bathrooms and stuff. And we were just amazed. And at the time, we were both studying music together. But, you know, us studying music wasn't as interesting as being a recording artist, you know, because the recording was just like so amazing to us. Where studying music was like, what is this fugue? You know, here's, you know, ear things. And it was just like, it just didn't seem so engaging. And, you know, one of my heroes being Brian Eno, who used the recording studio as an instrument, is, you know, like where we kind of headed off. Long story short, we started recording together. People started hiring us to record things. And then this one guy hired us to record a record for him. And this is when I was at Minneapolis College of Art Design. And Mark was living in Madison, but we still worked together. And we record this guy's album. And it was called Mean Old Elephant. It was this group called Mean Old Elephant. We put out one EP.
Mean Old Elephant?
Mean. That's awesome. Mean Old Elephant. And we put out this one EP. And he said to us, he goes, you know what? I want to start a recording studio and I want you guys to run it. And I'm all of 21. And I said, okay. And so we ended up, that ended up turning into Pachyderm, you know, the Pachyderm recording studios, which is still in business, you know, 35 years. Yeah. 35 years later, it's still in business. It's one of the legendary recording studios in the country. And that's really kind of where it ended up. At the same time, I had a record deal with Columbia Records. They were, you know, courting my band. I was working in the studio recording, you know, other bands, recorded with a lot of, you know, like the Minneapolis stuff, the Jayhawks, Soul Asylum. I worked with a lot of really, you know, huge engineers and producers that kind of came through there. And I was firmly entrenched. I thought that's what I was going to do. But then I turned 26 and I thought to myself, it's like, do I love doing this or am I good at it? You know, it's all I've known. It's all I've been doing. And so I had, I guess what people refer to as a quarter life crisis, you know, like kind of when you get 26, 27, you're like, oh, what am I going to do with my life? And I just had a lot of questions about doing music. So I left, I quit and I went back to film school and had no plan. And at this point, I've already engineered an album that went on to win a Grammy, a multi-platinum album that won a Grammy. I was one of the engineers on that record. Nirvana, you know, was in the recording studio at the time. It was a huge success. And I don't know, I just wasn't feeling it. So I went back to school. No idea what I wanted to do.
Can I stop you right there?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
I got two quick questions. Well, sure. I don't know if they're quick questions, but two questions. You said that this question, am I good at it or do I love it? And I'm going to push on that a little bit because some of the advice I've gotten on the show before, which I think I agree with, but I don't know, is that sometimes becoming proficient at something, becoming better at it leads to passion versus the other way around. And I'm curious how you conceptualize that because a lot of times, the creative work isn't fun and it's not exciting. And how do you know that you aren't just going through a dry spell with your craft versus this point you were at where you're like, I genuinely don't love it?
Because I was remarkably depressed.
Well, that's a given.
I was remarkably depressed. And, you know, I mean, I'm not going to lie and I'm not going to endorse this. I don't think this is a good thing. But, you know, being involved in music as much as I was and at the age I was smoking a lot of pot. And when I ended up being 25, I said, I hate this. You know, I can't stand it. So I just quit. I didn't smoke pot anymore.
Good for
I didn't,
you.
Didn't do anything. And I just went through a huge paradigm shift mentally. And I think that had a lot to do with it because then I'm like, well, do I love doing this or am I just, you know, kind of good at it? And I think that's what it was. I was just looking for a massive life change because I was just, you know, fundamentally unhappy with where my life was, even though the appearance was, I owned one of the coolest recording studios in the country. I'm working with these huge bands. Yes. And I was just like, I kind of hate my life. You know, I kind of don't know. I don't know what I would need to do here to find happiness. And so I quit. I just kind of walked away from it.
I love that you shared. Thank you for sharing that, because we don't give ourselves permission. I know I don't, to sometimes just freaking quit things if we're not feeling it. It can be working. People might think you're crazy, but if you genuinely know in your bones, this isn't what I want to do, giving yourself permission to do that, that's badass.
Thanks. It was a very uncomfortable time, because when I went back to school, I was like old, you know, I was 27 and everyone was like, wow, you're so old. Why are you coming back to college? And they would be like, why are you, you used to own this really cool recording studio where Nirvana's at. So why are you back in school? And I was like, you may never understand until you get there. You know, you may never understand.
Is it true that the studio was haunted? That's what you said on somewhere else.
Oh yeah, it's haunted. Not the studio, the house.
Can I just ask you about that real quick?
Yeah.
I want to know, like, how do you know it was?
People saw things there. And that really creeped me out. I've never physically seen anything. I've felt stuff. Like, I walked into the house one night and all I can describe is the house was darker than black. It was so dark. And at the time we had cats living there, and the two cats ran up to me and they stood in front of me and they just stared at me, and their pupils were massive and they're just like staring at me. And I'm like, this doesn't feel right. So I actually drove up to Minneapolis and stayed overnight at my girlfriend's house because I was so freaked out about it.
Wow.
But yeah, I mean, people, this one woman walked down into the studio and she's like, I swear, she goes, I just saw a woman walking a poodle in your front yard. And I was walking up to her and she just vanished. And we're just like, oh my God, because when we moved into the house, you know, it was like this big 6,000 square foot house with the indoor pool and all this sort of stuff. There was a wallpaper, hand painted wallpaper mural in the pool room that was damaged just from years of, you know, humidity and stuff that we had to tear the wallpaper down. We didn't really want to, but we had to because it was just moldy. And on there was a woman and her poodle. And I was just like, it was a woman and her poodle. And this woman would never have known that there was a woman and a poodle. And she's like, yeah, a woman and like a little poodle is walking in the front yard. And I was like, oh, that's really creepy, because we, our closest neighbor is a mile and a half away. There's no way that anyone would be in that front yard. That's super creepy that you said that. There was one woman who said, hey, your house is really freaky. And I was like, okay. And she was, I was sitting in the living room making hats. And she said, I saw this giant orb, this black orb floating in your living room. And I was like, okay, that's a little weird. And then I was talking to somebody else and he was kind of in shock. And I was like, what's going on? And he was just like, you would not believe what he goes, I thought I was dreaming, but in the same room, he said, I saw these two kind of egg-shaped things rotating around each other. And then they collided and made one big orb. And that was on the same day that woman said that she saw that. And these two people never met. They never talked. They didn't know each other. So there's something going on there. There's been like paranormal investigations at that house where they're like, yeah, there's something kind of weird going on there. Like I said, I've never seen anything. I've experienced like really creepy thoughts while I've been there. But yeah, who knows?
How do you think, and then we'll get back to the timeline here in a second. Yep. But that the reason I wanted to ask you about that is, I'm very drawn to the thought and the idea of kind of this spiritual creative element that's outside of all of us. And I'm curious, I have no idea your belief system on that. You might think I'm totally crazy, but I'm curious, like creating an environment that's kind of heavy with something that's dark. I wonder, do you think that affect the creative process at all? Like, is there any kind of spiritual element to creativity in your opinion? That's a deep ass question, isn't it?
No, it is. I'm glad you asked me that, because I like working at night. My entire life,
really?
I've worked at night. Oh yeah. I mean, my most prolific hours are between 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. is when I work, is when I write, is when all my ideas come to me, is when I did music. It's when I, you know, really kind of felt things. And the only way I can put it is that, without getting too, you know, woo-woo about anything, but I think that what I refer to as an attendant to the muse. You know, like I think that, you know, we are people who kind of seek out things, and I don't know how the universe works. I don't really pretend to know how the universe works, but I think that we have a certain antenna to the muse, and maybe it's just my level of attention deficit disorder that, you know, can't handle distraction in the daytime and at night there's no distraction. But I've always kind of felt that there is something a little bit different and a little bit almost, you know, spiritual without implying religion, but there's almost something about how the universe kind of surrounds you. And when I'm at night, my antenna to the muse is just, there's just no distractions. You know, like it's like I have a direct connection with whatever is motivating me, you know, like whatever that might be. And maybe it's all internal, but you know, you kind of externalize things that kind of make sense of them. But I always kind of felt that. And working at night, I feel really inspired. You know, working in the daytime, I just don't really feel that inspired. But at nighttime, I can kind of feel the energy kind of welling up inside of me. And that's the only way I can really describe it. But I've always worked at night. You know, I've always been a night owl. I enjoy going to bed at 6 a.m. I don't really like.
Interesting. So something was poking at you and drawing you to, you said you went to film school next.
Yeah.
Why film school?
Well, I was studying music, and I studied music for a year because I was a terrible high school student. And I met this Chinese composer who, in order to get his U.S. citizenship, had to be employed. So he took a job that was well beneath his capabilities. You know, his name is Kwok Ping Chen, and he's an avant-garde composer. And, you know, he's, you know, in those circles, he's pretty well known. And he convinced me, he's like, just study music with me. And I had no clue what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a rock star. You know, that's about where my career path was. It's like, well, I want to be a rock star. So he said, study music with me. And so I started studying music. And that's when I kind of got into recording. I didn't really enjoy the mathematics of music. You know, I kind of thought that it was much more, for me, it was much more intuitive. But I went to two concerts. And it's really funny because it was a Laurie Anderson concert. I'm not sure how familiar you are with her, but she's one of my all-time heroes. And it was a Frank Zappa concert. And the two could not be further apart than their last names are in the alphabet. You know, Laurie Anderson, Frank Zappa, polar opposite. Laurie Anderson is all about performance. You know, she is a musician, but the music is just there to accompany her performance is what it is, right? And you go and you see her and you're absolutely mind blown. Frank Zappa is all about the music and not about the performance, even to the point where he doesn't even have colored lights. He doesn't really even have lighting. You know what I mean? And I went to see his Shut Up and Play Your Guitar tour, and Laurie Anderson was profound. And I couldn't even speak after I saw her in concert. Mm. And Frank Zappa, I was kind of waiting to leave. And when I saw Laurie Anderson, I was like, screw it. This is what I'm going to do. You know, the music, I enjoy music, but I enjoy the whole experience. And so I dropped out of music school and enrolled in Minneapolis College of Art and Design based on the strength of an essay, because I didn't have any visual. I didn't have any visual material. I never took an art class to art school. And what I did is I said, I want to stage large scale operas is what I want to do. I want to make modern opera. And they liked my essay. And they said, and this was at a time too, where getting into college was a lot different than it is now, but they liked my essay and they were just like, yeah, this would be kind of, this guy will be a trip. You know, let's have this guy come into our school. He'll be kind of a trip because he seems nuts. So I made my own interdisciplinary degree, which was sound and film, because Laurie Anderson did film. And I didn't want to be a film maker. I liked film growing up, but I was never like one of those people who, you know, wanted to be a director or anything. And I wanted to combine sound and image. That's all I wanted to do. And went to school and ended up in a life drawing class wondering like, what did I just do? You know, it's like, I can't draw. And this, you know, one woman, Kathy Hemingway Jones, was one of my teachers. And I was just like, look, man, I am just struggling. And she's like, why? I was like, cause I can't draw. And she's like, no, you draw perfectly the way you draw. You know, your drawing is interesting. It's like, yeah, you're not rendering things exactly the way you look, but look at all your line qualities here. They have a character. And she's like, that to me is infinitely more important than whether or not you can draw or render something. And I was just like, oh my God, you know, so I stayed in school, and that's why I stayed in school until my music career took off. And that's why I dropped out of school to, you know, pursue the recording studio, did that for years and went back to school, got my degree and moved out to Seattle. Again, I had no idea what I wanted to do in Seattle. I got a job traveling around the country filming hot rod shows. And so every Thursday night or Friday, I would hop on a plane, travel to somewhere, shoot a hot rod show, fly back Sunday night or Monday morning, log all the tape, take Wednesday off, and repeat it again on Thursday. And I had no interest in cars. You know, it's like, I think cars are cool. So that's what I did. And then once that job kind of, you know, came to an end, I had no idea what I wanted to do. So because I had an interest in film and because I had experience with audio, I just started doing live sound for movies, you know, for independent films. Having never done that before, I'm like, how hard does it be? It's one mic and you kind of fix the acoustics in the room. Like, how hard can this be? So I did that. And through that, I got into conversations with people who are just like, you know, the biggest thing out here that we need are editors. Like, there's no place for independent films to edit. And I was like, oh, I love editing. I did really good in editing in film school. I mean, matter of fact, one of those rare instances of encouragement happened when I was in film school where I was just supposed to shoot something. So I shot a bunch of airplanes against a cloudy sky and went together, you know, went into the edit suite and cut those together to a piece of music that I created because my, you know, visual film and audio was my major. Yeah. And I had at that time a film teacher everyone was like so frightened of this guy. Everyone was so scared of this guy because he wasn't known for being nice or encouraging. And I played my piece for him and I was just like, yeah, you know, I'm bracing to get ripped apart. And I finished doing this piece and he sat down and he went like this and he turns around and looks at me back by the projector. And I was like, okay, here it comes. And he goes, you are going to be a fantastic editor. He goes, this was incredible. You're going to be an incredible editor. He goes, have you edited before? And I'm like, not really. He's like, you're going to be an incredible editor. I'll tell you that right now. So I had something to live up to.
That happened twice for you, the bassist and then now him.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it had a profound effect on me. And I was able, after I won my first Emmy, I was able to meet up with him again. And I told him, I was like, you are the reason I'm here. You know, you might not realize that, you might not even remember it. But when I was searching after I left the recording studio, I was searching for what the heck I wanted to do. And I was empty. I was just like a little leaf in a stream. And that was taking me wherever, like I had no clue. And so I said, but you turned around and you told me I was going to be a fantastic editor. And that really got me thinking, because I really enjoyed it. Maybe I will be good at that. And so I started doing that, you know, got my degree, moved out to Seattle. People told me that we needed editors. I took some money that I made when I sold my share of ownership in the recording studio and started an edit suite. And I just cut anything that moved, you know, and what I did is I hit up cinematographers and I was like, let me recut your reel because you have a lot of great footage. I can recut your reel for free. You know, like, and my monthly nut was $1,000 is what I needed to live on. If I could earn $1,000, everything was covered. So I'd be fine. So I started doing that and, you know, one thing led to another. And the weird thing is I've never in my life went out looking for a job. I've never have. I've never went out and said, hey, I want to work with you. Are you guys hiring? I've always been approached. So I kind of made a little name for myself in the small community that is Seattle. And then I got a call from this woman who is recruiting people for a company called Digital Kitchen. I'd never heard of them. I scoffed at commercials. I was just like, you know, like, yeah, I'm not going to do that. So I went out and met with Paul Matthias, and he and I really hit it off. And I was like, wow, this is really cool. And so he hired me. And within a week, I became head of editorial for his company. And within a year and a half, I edited the opening title sequence to 6 Feet Under and won an Emmy. So it just happened so damn fast. And then our company went, you know, Digital Kitchen at the time was about 12 people. Within the next 3 years, it was up to 400.
Wow.
Right. Yeah. It was a wild time.
So I have literally a list here of questions about creative process, your mindset with some of these things, especially because I feel like as an outsider who has known you for a whole 24 minutes and reading up on you this past weekend, I kept feeling like what I saw with your work is you're a bridge. You're able to just take so many different concepts and put them together in unique ways. I mean, that is what creativity is essentially, but you know, for you to be able to pair visual with sound and be able to hear somebody's idea and actually put it out there where they can physically see it. I mean, there's so much internally there that I want to learn from you about, but before we get there, can you take us from Digital Kitchen? Cause you didn't stay there.
Right.
And just give us an overview of what happened over the following years and where you find yourself out right now. That's a big question.
Well, yeah, I was at Digital Kitchen for 12 years. I started as an editor, and then I eventually became an executive creative director for an office in Chicago. I helped establish the office in Chicago. And we just worked and worked and worked and worked. Digital Kitchen owners had a very good idea because they noticed that the future was really about being an agency. You know, the future was really about creating ideas and getting paid for ideas and not necessarily just executing other people's ideas. So they wanted to become an agency. And that was the trajectory that they were on, to the point where they wanted to kind of get rid of all production. And I loved doing so much that after 12 years, I've been there long enough. I won 2 Emmys. You know, I had a pretty good track record of success. My office was making tens of millions of dollars a year, you know, and so I was like, I'm ready to, you know, kind of do something different. So I moved out to Los Angeles because I was eager to be another cliche. So I moved out to Los Angeles and started working with another friend of mine who was doing movie titles. And so for about a year, I did movie titles at a place called Yu and Company with a guy named Garson Yu. And that was good. I didn't enjoy making film titles as much as TV titles because there's a huge difference between those two things. TV titles are run by writers. Film titles are run by directors. A writer comes at you with a concept and they want you to develop a concept. They're like, for Dexter, he's like, he's a serial killer, but he's a good guy. You know, and that's pretty much all they told me. But for movies, they're like, we have, you know, whatever, 1800 frames, and we need to say these things, and it needs to be this, and it needs to be this, and this is the first scene of the movie. And you're like, okay, so it's more of an execution thing, unless you do main on end titles. But, you know, the TV titles for me were really, you know, much more interesting. And that's my whole trajectory there. So after doing movie titles, I, you know, hit up a friend of mine from college, and he was just like, hey, whenever you want to come over and work at my company as a creative director / director, let me know. And I was like, okay, I think it's about time. So I went to work at this place called Logan with Ben Conrad and Alexei Tylovich, and I was a creative director and a director, you know, so anything that they had that wasn't necessarily right for any one of the directors on the roster, all those jobs came to me. So if you look at my reel and you're seeing like, oh, he's done Liquid, he's done Stagecraft, he's done Beauty, he's done Product. That's why, because I was the Swiss Army knife in that, you know, one of the Swiss Army knives in that company. And then I kept on bidding against a company called Moving Picture Company, which I've never heard of before. And then they reached out and they said, you know, you've beat us on a couple of jobs. We'd like to talk to you about coming here to work with us. And so I went over to Moving Picture Company and headed one of their divisions called MPC Creative. And our intention was to turn it into a hybrid, you know, kind of creative agency. And we did that for about 5 years and was very successful. But, you know, the parent company, Technicolor, bought MPC's biggest competitor and then combined those two companies together. So my creative division, which was about 3 years old, was deemed, you know, redundant, you know, and so they kind of shut that down. But the guys from MPC were so cool with me. They're like, look, you cultivated these clients over the years. I have a shoot coming up with these clients. And they're just like, just take them. You know, you just take them. And so I took those clients and went on my own. And now I'm a freelance director. You know, like I'm a freelance director and I do commercial work for my living, for my job. I no longer edit as part of my job. I'm a director. I do photography. So that's kind of how I ended up. In the meantime, you know, I followed another path that was, you know, becoming a governor for the Emmys. And so I was a governor for the Emmys for 5 years. And I ran the TV title, main title category, and I created a new category for motion design. So those two things are what I did. So I've always had my hands in it. And I think one of the things that's kind of interesting about my career is what I'm doing now is the only time that I have decided to do something that I'm already good at. Every other time I've done, it's like, I can do that. I can probably do that. I can, yeah, film titles. Yeah, I can do film titles. You know, like, oh, editing commercials. I can edit commercials. I actually lied my way into my first job at Digital Kitchen. They said, Eric, do you know how to use an Avid? And I was like, absolutely. And they said, great, because we want to have you do a session with the head of marketing for FX Network Monday. And I was like, yeah, no problem. And I've never even seen an Avid before. So I was like, yeah, sure. Oh, that's, man, you know, what's the big deal, right? And so I called up my friend who was an instructor. He taught Avid and Media 100 and stuff. And I said, hey, I just got a job using an Avid. I've never even seen an Avid before. Should I be concerned? And he's like, oh, hell yeah. You should be really concerned because you're not going to know how to use it. And it's like so different. I'm like, oh. And so what I did, and this is, you know, serendipity. I looked up on the internet where I could get Avid training, and there was one in Seattle, and I'm like, oh great, there's somebody in Seattle. So I called them and they said, wow, you're in luck, because we're starting a new session tomorrow. So if you sign up for it, you can, and it was like on a Tuesday. And so I went Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I learned how to use an Avid. Saturday and Sunday, they granted me access, you know, so I could work on my own to kind of get a little bit more familiar. And then Monday I walk in and I'm with the head of marketing for FX. Yeah. So I completely lied my way into that. That went really well. And then, you know, I kind of, how I lied my way into directing is, you know, Paul, the founder of Digital Kitchen, walked into my edit suite one day and he said, Eric, you've directed music videos, right? And I said, yeah. And he's like, oh, God, thank God, because we need somebody to direct this piece next week. And I was like, yeah, that's no problem. So I had to go home and figure out how I was going to direct this thing. So I've always kind of put myself, you know, I've always reckless, right? Just kind of reckless, yeah. And not being cautious at all. The times I've been cautious in my life have been the least productive and the most boring times of my life. The times where I've been a little crazy and getting in well over my head have always turned out, always completely turned out just fine.
So the common advice, you know, is niching down and getting excellent and becoming a master at one thing. And we were just talking before we hit record, Sam Jones was one of the first people I felt like who, not that I needed permission, but kind of gave me permission to say, be multifaceted. I'm multifaceted. I ride dirt bikes and I direct and I have photography and, you know, he's a writer and he likes to cook and he does all of these things. And it meant a lot to me for him to say that, because I've always felt, I'm like you, if somebody's like, hey, Heather, you know how to do this? I'm like, hell yeah, I do. I'll figure it out. Yeah, right. Because yeah. I'm also just very curious. I'm so curious about the world. I'm curious though, with you looking back over your career, are you glad you approach things that way? Do you wish you would have reeled things back at all? What are some of your reflections looking back over those years?
Oh, that I was too cautious. Yeah, I was way still? Too cautious. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Still?
Still?
Tell me more.
Yeah, no, I mean
you think that you were too cautious even though you lived very adventurously and said yes to things.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I should be doing much different things than I think I am now. I mean, that's kind of the pressure that I have on myself, and I should be a much more prolific at what I do. I wrestle a lot with procrastination, but that all comes, I think, from an area of perfectionism, you know, and perfectionism, procrastination, and self-doubt are like yin and yang. I mean, they all completely work together.
Totally.
But I don't like conflict, you know, I don't like conflict. I don't like unhealthy competition and all that sort of stuff. So I think whenever that situation has come up, I've avoided it. And I think looking back, I shouldn't have avoided it. I should have said, you know, like, what's the big deal? You know, like, what's the big deal? I should really have more films that I made under my belt. There's a lot of things that I really should have done, and I should have done more. And it kind of goes back to what Andy Warhol told Lou Reed. You know, like Andy Warhol said to Lou, it's like, did you write any songs? And he's like, yeah, I wrote a song, but I lied. You know, he didn't write any songs. And Andy Warhol said, you only wrote one song, you should have wrote 10. You know, and Lou Reed hadn't written any. So I kind of feel that I need kind of an Andy Warhol on my shoulders, you know, pushing me forward. So yeah, I should have taken bigger risks. I should have taken bigger chances. I shouldn't have been so afraid to fail, even though I hadn't really been afraid to fail. In hindsight, if I could go back, I would just be a lot more bold about how I went through things.
I'm so glad you said that, Eric. I know you don't know me from anything, but if I were to guess one thing that I would look back and tell myself, it'd be the same thing, because I'm just like you. I think I have a lot of really great ideas and I feel so many nudges. I like how you said this fear of conflict, you know, challenging ideas, saying, no, I don't like that idea, or not being aggressive enough to get the part or the role or whatever it is. You know, it's almost like this Southern, like, you go on ahead, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And I have that in my bones. And so I appreciate you sharing that side to things. I want to dig in, if it's okay, a little bit to your creative process, because despite you saying you wish that you'd been more aggressive and done more things, what you have created is incredible. And it is a gift that you have. But I know that there's things that you've learned along the way that's helped you become a better storyteller. So I know we could go a lot of directions with this, but what I wanted to really dig into is this idea of bringing something to life. Like you just said earlier, somebody will give you a concept with something and you almost have to create the world in your head and birth it. Dexter, he's a serial killer, but he's actually a nice guy or whatever. When you're getting these little breadcrumbs of something and you have to form an entire world, what is your process there? Do you go to writing first? How do you, or does it come instinctually to you? Anything you want to share with your process?
A lot of things do come really instinctually.
Okay.
Like one of the first things that I thought of with Dexter that I thought was so interesting, and it's a concept that they decided to not take, was that the word Dexter in all caps is exactly the same right side up as it is upside down. So D-E-X, except for the T and the R. They're the same word upside down as it is right side up. And so I wanted to kind of use that. That's the first thing that kind of came to me when I was saying he's a serial killer, but he's a good guy. And he's exactly the same person in both worlds. And I was like, it's so interesting.
They didn't do that on purpose? They didn't choose that word on purpose?
No, it was based on a book. Yeah, it was based on a book. So some things just kind of hit me right in the face. But, you know, most of the time, and I'm as you can tell, I've got a lot of energy. You know, like ideas kind of ping around my head, you know, like constantly. I can't go to sleep at night because I'm thinking about stuff. And there's usually a lot, you know, like a lot going on. So there's a book that I read a long time ago, and it sounds really corny, but it's a great book. It's called A Technique for Producing Ideas. And it was written by an ad guy.
I just got that book.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. And that's reading that book. It's basically how I work. So what I do is I research the living hell out of things. Like I research like really? Crazy, and I write and I write and I write. And then I detach. I go away. And, you know, part of it is I'm kind of an expert procrastinator. So maybe my procrastination, you know, helps me kind of detach. But when I detach, all of my subconscious starts coming up with ideas and connections, and something will hit me like completely out of the blue. Like absolutely out of the blue. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. You know, like a word or a phrase or an image, or, you know, something like happens serendipitously that I'll be paging through it. And I'm just like, oh my God, like this encapsulates what I'm thinking. And so that happens. And when I read the book, A Technique for Producing Ideas, it's like, wow, I kind of do that without knowing it, but it actually is a technique. And so it's a great book. It's like 50 pages. It's a really easy read. There's nothing very academic about it. Very straightforward. Mm-hmm. It almost seems kind of like common sense, but that is my creative process. I research the living heck out of everything. And then because I'm an editor, I'm, you know, in my mind, I'm very, very, very precise and buttoned up about everything.
Right.
And because I'm, you know, obsessed with communication, you know, like I work and work and work. And like, unlike a lot of directors, I write all my treatments. I put my decks together. I do all my artwork in the treatments. I do like absolutely everything on my own, but that's because I have to. That's just part of my process. Because when I get on the phone with a client,
can I ask you a newbie question?
What's that?
What's a treat? I'm sorry for this ignorant question, but what's a treatment?
Oh, a treatment. I'm working on one right now, which I'm really excited about. It's an independent project, but basically a treatment is a director's vision on how I'm going to make your piece. You know, if it's a commercial, and I do a lot of work for Fidelity. They kind of come to me with a pretty good, you know, like a solid concept, but, you know, there's enough there for me to add things to it. It's like, how are we going to do this? And so what a treatment is me gathering all this information from a agency or a client, and then kind of putting it back to them and setting a plan. Like, this is what's going to happen. This is what your spot's going to look like. This is the story behind it. This is everything that's going to happen. If you're interested, I'll send you a couple of treatments just so you can look them over and see what
that would make my day.
Okay. I'll do that.
That would make my day.
Yeah.
So when you bring it back to them, is it up for negotiation? Do y'all go back and forth with each other? So this is your vision, but then how long does that process take to kind of get a final treatment? I don't know if that's the right word.
Yeah. What I do, and I'm very conscientious of the fact that these people have worked on this idea too. You know, so it's not for me to come back and go, you know, ignore everything that you've done. Here's what I want to do. I don't do that.
Right.
And again, it goes back to how I work with a guitar player in the recording studio. He comes in, it's, you know, he or she, it's her song. That's the way they play guitar, that they're doing this thing. I'm here to kind of help make it better. As a bassist, I'm playing with a guitarist who comes up with a chord progression, and it's my role to kind of make the music a little bit better with my harmonic movement and what I can do to kind of color things, right? As a creative director, mm-hmm. I take an idea or a concept that somebody has and I kind of make it better. So right now what I do as a director is these people will come to me and they're like, yeah, we've got this idea and we want to use your insight, you know, to make this better. So I come in with a bunch of ideas and I remind them. It's like, look, all of this is based on a 20-minute conversation that we had a week ago, right? So this is just my first whack. This is kind of where this conversation inspired me to go. Doesn't mean that everything's written in stone. What I want is for you to look at this and then kind of come back to me and let's make this thing better, because you're going to have insights that I'm unaware of, right? And there's going to be conversations that you may have had internally with your client that I'm completely unaware of, but there's going to be something in my treatment that's going to have you go, oh my God, what's really neat is this. And that's the way I like to work. You know, like I am just presenting you with what you'd inspired me to create and nothing's written in stone. Here's where I'm at. You know, you gave me where you're at. I gave you where I'm at. Let's work together and kind of make this thing the way we both want it up until time of production. And then when we're on set, we have absolutely nothing to worry about except for, you know, just performances, you know, camera, all this sort of stuff. We don't make anything up. So a treatment is basically an invite to have people collaborate with what they've inspired me to do, is the way I look at it. And that usually takes, the call will be about an hour. And then they may award the job a couple of days later. And then we work together for a couple of weeks up until production.
And how much does all of that consume you when you're in the middle of production? Is it all you think about, or are you able to put it to the side?
No, it's all I think about. I wanted to be able to kind of concentrate on one job at a time. Sometimes I concentrate on two jobs at a time. I don't really love doing that because I just get so deep into the details of one job. And I think I could probably be a little bit better at, I don't even know the word, what's it called when you have other people do stuff?
Delegating.
See, I don't even know the word. I think I could be better at delegating stuff so I could get more done. Yeah. But I like to do that. So that's, getting back to your original question, that's how I work. I develop things. I let it sit. And, I sent you a little note, about the idea of boredom. And I think creative people are inherently curious. And I think that there's a lot out there that you can distract yourself with. I think you can sit on Instagram for an entire day and look at amazing stuff and not do anything. And I think if you put all that stuff down and you're bored, you're going to like, I'm going to pick up my camera. I can't sit here and do nothing. I'm going to pick up my camera. I'm going to go do something. So I think boredom is something that everybody should aspire to, because it's kind of what keeps you creative.
Let's press into this just a little bit. This is where I want to say that I'm a newly discovered creative. I just realized a couple of years ago that I'm creative and now it all makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I've been going deep down the rabbit hole, learning about process, craft, all the things, and interviewing incredible people like you. And I get kind of envious when I talk to folks who are doing, like, I don't want to say real production, but like another caliber of work. Because it seems as though, and please tell me where I'm missing the mark here, that there's more concentrated effort, a collaborative thing on one piece, and it's just really pushed to the point of excellence. And the reason I'm mildly envious of that is I kind of came up through the vein of content creators, mm-hmm. where you are taught, and rightfully so, that you spew out stuff to get better and better and better.
Right.
But there's such a heavy emphasis on produce. If you're not posting every single day or every other mm-hmm. day, you're falling behind.
Yep.
And there's less collaboration, because you see my team over here, they're right. They're great. So as a creator, I feel kind of like this nudge, like I want to really dive in deep to one idea and create something I'm really, really proud of. But I don't have those tools, resources just yet. Maybe that's an excuse. And I view myself as more of a content creator, which is a lot faster pace and it doesn't feel as polished. And messy question, Eric, but I'm just curious your perception, because you've done things professionally for so long and you see what we're trying to do in the content creation space, and not to poo-poo on it, but am I wrong in saying that those two worlds are vastly different and maybe we could learn a little bit more from the high-end production stuff? Or do you think that even matters where we're heading as a society? That was a big ass question.
It's funny. I was laughing when you said that because I'm envious of the content creators. You know, I'm
really.
I'm really envious of the content creators and the people who, whatever is driving them to do something every day. To me, I'm a workaholic and I'm lazy. You know, like those two worlds, like I can sit on the couch for 4 days straight and not do anything. I mean, I honestly can't. It's not hard for me. Mm. And I look at these people who, you know, are self-motivated and making things every day on their own. And I'm really envious of that whole process. And it's something that I'm working hard to try to, I'm trying to write a book right now. And it's hard enough to just have time on my own without even any deadline or involving any other people, just to kind of get into my office and write, you know, like that's really hard. So I'm really envious of that. I think where the world is going is production, you know, money isn't getting bigger, you know, advertising is free. Yeah. You know, I mean, I just don't think that the world is going to be these massive, you know, Byzantine productions forever. I think advertising is at a point right now where it's really trying to figure out its future. And, you know, they hire influencers and stuff to kind of create messages. And I don't know if I'm even answering that question right. I mean, the only thing about me was, you know, having this insane curiosity and maybe mixed with some sort of underground, you know, narcissistic feel that I had to get my idea out there, that I did stuff. You know, but I have so much work that I don't put out there because I'm still trying to find my voice. And I realize I don't have one yet. I don't really have the voice that I want to
have. After all this time, you feel that way.
Oh, yeah. I think I'm the book I'm working on right now is called Things I Know to Be True and the Stuff Todd Told Me. And it's really about my upbringing and all the things that I've had experienced firsthand. And then the stories that are kind of secondhand stuff. So it's kind of a mixture between, you know, mythology and actual things. But I don't really think that I have an adequate voice visually yet to be able to kind of put that together unless I lean on a large production, you know. So like me as a person working on my own, and if you look through my Instagram page, you can see that I messed around a little bit with storytelling and with illustration. I do some photography, you know, that I like. But all the stuff that I'm working toward finding my voice, that's a part of it, but I'm not putting it out there as my voice because I want to develop something that I think is, you know, kind of to the level of what I do in my profession. And I don't really want to be who I am as this one person and then have some incredibly amateurish stuff come out, because then it's going to kind of undermine, you know, this monolithic mythology that I've created for myself as being one thing. So I want to find my voice before I put something out there. And that's been really hard. And I'm envious of people who can just do it, you know, because I think that ideas are great. I think execution is everything, you know, and I think that, you know, there's so many amazing ideas and there's so many amazing artists that I know who haven't created anything. And there's so many people who have the ability to execute. And those are the ones who are successful. And what I would tell my people that I'd work with, you don't have to wait to be the best. And I'm contradicting what I'm saying, but it's like, if the best people were the most successful, then everything would be amazing, but not everything's amazing. So you have to figure out like, what is success? Like, how do people get success, and how can you learn from those people with the talent level that you have that might be greater than the people who are more successful than you? So like, what is that? You know, like that's what people need to figure out. So for me, working on huge productions has been a bit of a hindrance because I, you know, rely on a pretty big apparatus of other really talented professionals to help me, you know, convey my ideas. But then working with just myself, I'm like, wow, you know, I have a production designer, you know, who I collaborate with. I have a cinematographer who I collaborate with. I have all these people who I collaborate with, and we do create consistent visions that are very unique to what I think. But without those people, I'm left with getting the skills of being a good photographer where I think my vision is going to be up to where it is in my professional life. Does that make any sense at
all? It does. I think where we're meeting at in the middle here is, you know, you talk about letting go of some of the production quality and the need for that to be able to take more action, and then coming from the content creation side, I recognize and see the need for space. And like you said, boredom and taking time with something, because that's something I don't feel like I do enough is take genuine time with something and turning my face and looking at it another angle, because everything is so fast that I don't know if I allow ideas to really mature that the way that they could. So it's like this I hate the word balance. It drives me nuts because it sounds so boring, but there has to be something to meet in the middle of there. You know what I mean?
Well, what I would have to say is I think from where I view it, I think you're incredibly brave. I mean, I think you have the courage to do something that I'd love to do, but I just don't have the confidence in what you're doing for me to be able to do that. I look at these content creators, you know, and especially people like you and, you know, people like Sean, you know, and people like Sam who talk to camera and they're on camera talent and they're doing these things and they're all brilliant. That's takes so much courage, you know, courage that, you know, like I say, I'm a behind the scenes person. The website that I have is the first website I've ever made in my life. You know, I've never needed one, but I felt now I kind of need to tell my story.
Yeah, you do. You have a lot to give. And now that I'm friends with you, I'm going to start bothering you to get on camera more, because I think you have a lot that this world needs to hear.
Well, I think,
I
mean,
something for you?
That, yeah, that's great. I would absolutely love that.
I wanted to ask you about taste. I know that's a weird topic, but I'll be honest with you. I think that's one of the things I'm the most insecure about as a creator. I don't feel like I have a lot of resources, and so I'm kind of creating from a very homegrown place. But also B, I guess the way that I grew up and the things that I've been exposed to have been very one-dimensional. And I guess I've noticed in myself when I'm creating, I don't feel like I have as good of a taste as I want to. And I'm frustrated because, you know how when you were leaving the studio, you just felt this tension, like this isn't it. I kind of feel like that when I'm doing my work, like I'm so close to something, but I can't pinpoint exactly what it is. And when I look at people like you who've been able to visually create such beautiful work, now I'm not a photographer, right? But I am a storyteller, and I know that I could get so much better. And I'm curious, I know this is a messy question, but developing taste as an artist, what would you advise someone like me? Is it literally just looking at other people's work? I mean, where would you go if you know something could be better, but you're just not hitting it?
Story of my life. Well, first of all, I think going through art school and having all your stuff critiqued constantly is kind of where I grew a backbone. Don't care what anyone thinks. And I think, you know, that question about taste and should I put something out there, and maybe if you're not feeling, you know, inside your soul that it's working, well, then keep on working. Cause that's the way I feel about my personal vision on things. I don't think it's working yet. I'm not exciting myself to the degree that I think I should be exciting myself. And that's kind of what I'm working towards. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting there. I'm getting better. I'm getting really good at some things, you know, that I've been practicing on. But I think, you know, people fall into a trap of comparing themselves, you know, and I think, you know, there's one thing about, you know, being concerned about putting yourself out there and your taste. I think that's what's so great about Instagram. You know, I put a bunch of stuff out there. I look at from my very first post and now you can see a development. You can see me communicating better. You can, not that these are my personal visions, but some of them are, you know, and they kind of keep on getting better and don't care. You know, like one of my good friends, you know, he would be like, you know how when you make something and you really love it and then somebody says, oh, that's terrible, and then you question it, and I'm like, no, that has not in my DNA. Usually I'm like, you really think this sucks? I think you're missing it. So I don't know if that's arrogance, you know, or what that is, but I have never, if I thought something was cool, nobody can ever convince me that it's not. It's never happened. You know, I just, you know, kind of tune that out. I don't care. I understand if somebody can rationalize why a thing that I did wasn't successful. And I can typically agree. No one's a bigger critic of what I do than I do. But as far as working on your own personal thing, first of all, I think making a project is incredibly important, you know, because a project has, it's projects quantifiable, you know, I'm going to make this book of short stories. That's quantifiable. And you're going to refine what that project could be the more you do it. You know what I mean? You're going to kind of keep on working at it. You're going to hone it. You're going to hone it. You're going to hone it. And while you're doing that, you're going to be getting better. And your confidence in what you are creating is going to grow. So it's like focusing mm-hmm. on one project and not thinking about the big, huge picture. I want to be a writer. Well, that is an abstract right. pursuit. You know, I want to be a writer. I want to make right. a film. It's like, okay, so what do I do tomorrow? You know, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, so make a project. That's what my book is about for me. It's a project because I have lived a life that people would listen to the stories and think I'm lying, but I'm not lying. These are all true. Coming face to face with a rock star in my recording studio who had a pillowcase over his head and a bloody knife in his hand who was looking for his brother at 4 a.m. So I have a lot of really interesting stories I can tell. And people are just like, really? That really happened? I'm like, oh, yeah. So that's what I'm working on. And I think through talking about my because I love telling stories, the stories I know are things that I've experienced. And so I am putting a book together of my own experiences. That could be a film. I don't know. I don't really care. But I want to put this book together as a step one. And I think through doing that, I'm going to find my voice. And so I think getting something that is less of an abstract notion about what I want to be, because I want to make a film. You know, I think I have stories that I think should be films, but this is the first step in finding my voice in being that storyteller. And I'm going to tell the stories about my life before I can start telling stories that I make up.
Well said.
Does that?
Well said.
I don't feel like I'm answering any questions.
No, you are. This is what you just told me to do. And you're 100% right. And it's something that I have been deeply avoiding and procrastinating on.
Sure.
Because I'm a scared little girl, let me tell you, but you nailed it. The whole idea of a project.
Yeah.
I've started scripts before. I've written down stories. I haven't done anything with them. And so it's easy to kind of, with so many tools and so many things we could do, to frail around and just say, I can do anything. So you don't focus in and do one thing. So having a project is,
and if you don't feeling finish, convicted. If you don't finish, you never fail, right?
Oh, you're getting me. So,
I think failure is one of the most important things that people should experience. You know, I think, because failure, it's like, I know one of my coworkers, dear friends, a person that I idolize, his name is Mason Nickel, and he's just a phenomenal creative. He and I were working together on a job, and he had this experiment that he was going to do. And, you know, at that time he was feeding me all the footage, and we put it in the edit and we played it back. And he goes, oh boy, that didn't work, and was okay with it. And to me, it's like, how, I couldn't do that. But, you know, he took that as a learning thing. He's like, well, that didn't work the way I thought it would, you know, so I know I'm going to do something different. And I think that's what, you know, when you get a project and you hone in on it and you finish, and you can evaluate, you know, the areas where it was successful and not successful. That's how you become better. And one of my biggest concerns, I know people, you know, talk about AI, or people talk about, you know, like I'm very interested in the democratization of arts and tools, which I don't necessarily think is a good thing. Depends. It's not an edict, but, you know, it's something that I think. Anyway, AI is taking failure out of the equation. And I think that's terrible. I mean, people can talk about, well, AI is going to steal my jobs. AI isn't, you know, it's this and that. I think AI and a lot of these new tools that democratize the arts takes failure out of the equation. And I think that is awful, because failure is where you walk outside with your film camera and you take a picture of your grandmother and you develop it and you get it back and you're like, wow, it was underexposed. So what do I do next time? I got to make sure that there's light. You know, I got to make sure there's enough light on the subject. And so then you take your grandmother and you position her in light. You know, you just became a better photographer, you know, through failing the first time. Taking photos on your iPhone, you don't think about things in those terms because your iPhone fixes it. So you never really have to think about things that didn't work because it's fixed it for you, right? And so I think failure and making something and having it be a disaster is good. You know, I mean, Brett Favre, like I'm a Packers fan, you know, Brett Favre, quarterback, one of the greats, you know, is going to be a Hall of Famer if he's not already in the Hall of Fame. Threw more interceptions than any other quarterback in any career in NFL history. So, I mean, he was, you know, he was reckless and he, you know, he just went for it and he threw more interceptions than anybody, but he's a great quarterback. So clearly failure to him, you know, wasn't really something that held him back. You know, it was like he kept on going in the face of, you know, objective failure, throwing more interceptions than any other quarterback in NFL history. I think through failure, you get better. And then what you do is you see that your improvement. And then you kind of start getting a voice, and it's a whole process. But, you know, getting back to your point, how do you do that? Getting a project and finishing a project and moving on to another project and finishing it. You know, you're doing that with this. I mean, you have what you have your, was it Unconventional Leaders? And then you have your podcast and a bunch of stuff that you work on. I mean, you're doing it. You know, you have a very strong voice. You've got a really great presence, you know, in these interviews and everything like that. I mean, I'm sure you're doing it way more than you give yourself credit for that you think. And through this, you know, you're enabling stories to happen. So I you know, my only advice would be just like, you know, it's advice I give myself. You have to do it. Execution is everything.
I know.
Yeah.
Let me ask you one more. Go. I know I'm way over. One more, real quick, and I promise I'll make this fast, and we'll be done. You have said a couple of times, and I think this is really interesting. This idea of pushing the envelope a little more, being a little bit more risky, and I'm going to read a quote to you real quick that I have of you here. You were talking about the importance of being an artist is not technical ability, but it's the ability to think up new ideas and convey your ideas. That's the most important thing. So we get trapped. I know I get trapped in the technical side to stuff if I'm a good creator, but really the essence of it is this ideation process and the willingness and ability to push those ideas out the door. Mm-hmm. And so if you couple that with this idea of being a little more risky, I'll tell you what, Eric, I've been really trying to push myself lately to think differently and push ideas a little bit further than I think they need to go. So sometimes an idea will come to me and I'll just run with it, as opposed to doing what Matthew Dix talked about the other day, the edges of an idea and pushing an idea's boundaries. And I'm curious if you have any insight on how to get more risky with an idea and pushing them outside of the box a little bit, because you're an idea generator. You have to constantly come up with things. So is that just a practice? How would you advise me to stretch ideas a little bit more?
I can just say what motivates me is like when I'm stuck.
Sure.
There's a voice in the back of my head that says, someone could figure this out. You know, someone could do something that's really amazing here. And then I'm like, gosh, you know, there is an answer here. You know, there is an answer. And so I keep on going for it. As far as pushing ideas out, it just, I just get taken back, you know, to the, you know, to the, like, what do they call that? Lizard brain stuff. You know, like the first time I heard Kiss, you know, I heard Kiss shouted out loud when I was, you know, a child, and I'm tearing up right now just thinking about this. I went to see Kiss as an adult and they played Shout Out Loud and I started crying, and I'm getting tearful even just remembering it because of what that song meant to me. And there's a thing about, you know, it's not really giving people their money's worth, but really respecting their attention. And, you know, for me as a creative person who's, you know, hired to expand upon other people's ideas, I do that because I want them to know that I respect, you know, what they're doing so much that it inspired me. Right. But as far as like pushing ideas out there, I'm my own biggest critic. You know, when I was editing, I could see my personality in my edits and it really bothered me. You know, it's like, oh, here you're trying to show off, you know, here you're trying to do this. And so I'm a really harsh critic on myself. Like, there's been times in my life where I said, everything that I've done is absolute garbage. You know, it's everything is terrible. And I still look at some of my best work and I'm like, yeah, there's really terrible aspects of this. So I keep on, you know, it's that failure that keeps me going. But as far as like expanding upon ideas and going out there and expanding upon them further, I don't know. I mean, I think it just kind of goes back to an inherent curiosity about what you're doing and how other people made you feel in the past, like work that's really gotten under your skin and work that's just, you know, you've been just like, wow, I would love to use whatever talents that I have to make somebody else feel the way that these people made me feel. You know, like that's something that keeps me going. And again, like, sure, I'm probably a sociopath. You know, I'm probably a narcissist. you know, to like think that way, but that's kind of where I'm at. I want other people to feel, I want to return the gift that other people gave me. You know, it's like the first time I heard this record, you know, the first time I heard, saw this concert, the first time I saw this movie, or the first time I discovered this photographer's work conjures emotions inside of me. And, you know, it's probably arrogant, but I kind of feel that I should spend my time doing this for other people. There's no technique.
I think it's a brilliant way of.
You know, like I can't tell you like, oh, here's, you know, this technique, other than the technique for producing ideas, which I think is going to lead you to that, using your unconscious to kind of develop things. But what I do, I do so intuitively on many levels. That, and I'm my own greatest critic. And when I was an editor, and I was a very good editor, I would just try to, it's like, oh, I've seen that before. I've seen that before. You know, like I want to do something, I kept on pushing it, pushing it, until I get to a point where I'm like so excited by it that I know other people will be. Yeah, I don't know.
I love creativity so much. Is it, it's so like, you know, we said at the beginning, just kind of this idea of spirit, you know what I mean? And yeah, we can get better. Yeah, we can learn techniques. Yeah, I can pick your brain for an hour. But at the end of the day, it's how in tune are you with that nudge and that still small voice and trusting how you feel. And I think that's the most badass personal development church you could ever go to is leaning into that. It's beautiful. And listen, I kept you over. I think you are incredible. I think your work's brilliant. So much respect for you. I cannot believe you took time out of your day to talk to us, to spend time with us. Where would you like to direct our listeners to? I know you got a book coming out, which I'm really excited about. I'm going to push that out the door. I know that might be a little ways from between now and then. What do you want our listeners to go to?
You could go to my website, but I made the website for commercial clients, you know, but I think maybe a lot of people could get a lot of things out of it. I don't know.
If anything else, see your work. It's brilliant.
Yeah. Or just Instagram. You know, I tell some funny stories on Instagram from time to time. A lot of times I'll show pictures of my dog too.
Well, you said on your website, you're funny as fuck. That's what you said. So people are going to be.
I am pretty funny. I'm super funny. You know, a lot of times people don't realize it, but don't realize how funny I am. But yeah, I'm really funny. You know, when I was working with Conan O'Brien, I did the titles for his TV show when he was on The Late Night. And he was like saying, it's so interesting how us in the writer's room will write because somebody will come up with an idea and like no one laughs really. Someone comes up with an idea and they're like, it might be the funniest thing I've ever heard in my life. It's like, yeah, that is. Isn't that funny? Yeah, that's hysterical. That's so funny. And I thought that was so interesting because you would think a writer's room, everyone would be laughing their heads off, but I can relate to that.
No, it's so true. I was just on a call before this and the guy was telling me he wants to develop his comedic skills. He said, but I'm not funny. People don't laugh at me in real life. I said, that's nothing to do with it. Most of the comedians I know, I never laugh when I'm hanging out with them.
Right. Well, most of them are
that's not the thing.
Kind of dark people. You know, that's why they make such good, and like, you know, Robin Williams was so great playing a creepy dude in a 1 hour photo. You know, so great. Because I think there's a lot of darkness in those comedians.
Well, listen, all of it, your website with your permission, your Instagram will be linked up in the show notes if folks want to connect with you. Our very last question we ask all guests, what is something you are deeply questioning right now in this season of your life that you do not have the answer to? You're like, why I said yes to Heather Parody coming on our show?
No, it's why a friend of mine was trying to get me to join a cult a number of years ago. And one of the things that he told me is he said, you know how they train flies for a flea circus? You know how they train fleas for a flea circus? Because, you know, fleas can jump like 20 feet. You know, they can just jump, right? So how they train fleas for a flea circus is they put them in a container. So when they jump, they hit the top of the container and then train themselves to not be able to jump high because they don't want to hit the top of the container. So when that container's gone, the fly only jumps as high as the container would be. And that's how a flea circus works, you know, where they have like little fleas kind of jumping over stuff is because they've been trained to not extend themselves. I'm wondering what I have created for myself that is that cover. You know, it's like, what thing have I put out there where I keep on jumping up and hitting something and putting brakes on myself? And so that's kind of what I'm questioning. Mm-hmm. It's like, why didn't I do something different when I was in my rock band? You know, like, why did I do what I did? And so I, at this point, you know, I guess questioning, I look back in my life and see all the things that I thought should have been humongously successful that still I kind of harbor with some regret. My band, my recording studio, maybe my editorial career, all of these things, I think in hindsight, should have been bigger and more robust than they were. So what I'm questioning myself is, how am I holding myself back now? You know, like if I can witness that I've held myself back in the past, how am I holding myself back now? And that's hard to take. You know, because there's a lot of really ugly truth there. But I, you know, do I deserve attention? I don't know. You know, am I ideas worthy, you know, for other people to take the time for other people? I don't know. I'll find out. But yeah, I mean, I think if there's anything that I'm questioning is like, how am I holding myself back now like I did in my past?
Damn. I don't think there's anybody listening who can't relate to what you just said. I love your transparency, your honesty. I think you're far too modest. It's insane. It has been a freaking joy to have you, Eric Anderson. Thanks for agreeing to come on today.
Well, thank you. I mean, I'm really honored to do this.